little bit late and a little bit short. Earlier today, I spoke to President Bush and I offered him and Laura our congratulations on their victory. We had a good conversation. We talked about the danger of division in our country and the need, the desperate need, for unity, for finding the common ground, coming together. Today, I hope that we can begin the healing. In America, it is vital that every vote count and that every vote be counted. But the outcome should be decided by voters, not a protracted legal process. I would not give up this fight if there was a chance that we would prevail.
Division is going to be decided by the slaves on the vote, not some beat-down knuckleheads voting for what imperial administrator they want in office. It's clear now that this has been one of the great beat-downs in generations. But don't all you little liberals feel silly? All your big talk about running Boy George out of office. Wait a minute. He's not Boy George to you. He's your daddy. Daddy George. And then Carol, you have the nerve to say, we need to begin the healing. We'll heal ourselves with class warfare, fool. And then you say, I talked to Boy George about the desperate need for unity in our country. In other words, I'll do my best to corral my beat down liberals and progressives, Zinzag, Michael Parente, and others, to be obedient slaves to the empire once more. You know what time it is, slave time. You're listening to 104.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz on the internet, LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight, we're going to just shoot our way right into Beyond the Shadow segment, dealing with the thrill is gone. But when will the illusion, liberals, progressives, and other handkerchief heads, you know what we're going to talk about. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Do you expect me to vote for the lesser of two evils? Never. It's more like the evil of two lessers. That's like saying, M, choose your oppressor. Pick one, Jeffrey Dahmer or Hannibal Lecter. You want crack, coke, Pepsi, or Dr. Pepper. They all effed up, but neither one of them better. Because crack is like a Democrat, cocaine Republican, marijuana independent party, same government. You really think your vote count? Ask my folk down in Florida, didn't they straight throw they vote out? And them crackers act innocent, knowing they depend on this, benefiting from hush money from big businesses. Money is the president, dead prez, dollar bill, and I bet no convention ain't spending this. Soon they gon' need us, believe us. When did these cats pick rappers to be political leaders? Don't be pawns, be Lolita LeBrons. Run up on them arm like mother, it's on. If Congress don't make progress, let's change the process. No more times running for office. Talking like that, These people will call you crazy. What's crazy is ain't no difference between me and Jay-Z. The same boat brought us the same place from slavery, so we rock the same chains anyway, baby, baby.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
It is now. Beyond the shadow. And what we're going to deal with tonight is, the liberals, pacifists, progressives, have suffered one of their most embarrassing and shameless beatdowns in American bourgeois history. From P. Diddy to Howard Zinn to Hard Knock Radio and on, you had all of these liberals and progressives talking how they were going to smash Bush up. And what's so sad about it is not the idea of trying to smash up an imperial collaborator, but you tried to smash up an imperial collaborator by playing footsie with another one, Kerry. And where did he get you? Beat down and embarrassed. Shamed. We're going to explore this a little bit. And deal with how things got locked into an imperialist circle by many segments of the progressive, quote-unquote, community. And how many of them are just, bumbling their lips together, wondering where to go next and how to do it. But first, let's start off with Hard Knock Radio. And they start off their own show playing some defeated music. And I say defeated music is because they use it in this context. They start off playing the blues. This is a little, so-called conscious hip-hop based show. Playing the Thrill Is Gone. And then one of their people that they have on the show, Chris, talks about how the vote was beat down in Ohio. As if anyone should be shocked. But, let's see what these guys on Hard Knock have to say. And then let's take it from there. Check this out.
That's right. The thrill is gone. This is Hard Knock Radio. You know, didn't take us too long to figure out what song to start off with today. Stormy Wednesday afternoon. Everybody feeling bluesy. We all want to know what happened yesterday. So a lot of the discussion today is going to be centered around what happened, what won, what are we going to do? Tipper, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why don't you tell us about what's happening right now?
Okay, so I'll give you a little bit of background. I've been here for about a month. I'm from Oakland, and I've been in Ohio for the last month working Get Out the Vote to try to get Bush out of office. And all day yesterday, we've seen growth of voter suppression handed down from the Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell. We've had 35,000 people in Ohio with their vote, right to vote challenged. And so it's systemic voter suppression that's occurring here in Ohio and across the country. We've had lines of 5 hours, people waiting in lines to vote, folks who were turned away because they didn't have two forms of ID, which is illegal. Also, African Americans and people of color were challenged by white Republicans on their right to vote. So it's a crisis here in the United States. And so we've organized a mobilization called Democracy, Not Disenfranchisement. And we are on the steps of the Capitol right now with about 60 folks willing to risk arrest to stand up for democracy, which has been broken today.
All right, now here you have basically kind of the same kind of liberal shocked, you know, complaint. And it's not that these injustices aren't done, but this is a hallmark of the whole electoral process system. It has always been, from its very beginning, it was set up as a disenfranchisement tool. It was set up to give extra power and influence to the slave states and the slavers and stuff. It was set up not as a mechanism for all of the people. It was set up to maintain property and dominance for a particular class of people. So this has been a hallmark. It's pretty well known now, and not even really debated, that even in 1960, during the Kennedy versus Nixon election, that Kennedy really lost that election. But they just stole it. You know, they hijacked a couple of states and stuff. You know, some of Kennedy's buddies in there, or friends of his father, you know, that he had deals with and stuff like that. And they turned in a fictitious vote for him. These guys are criminals. That's what they do. But if you spend all of your time trying to get people to vote, this is not real education. Because one, it's basically a game where you're trying to motivate people not to fully understand the overall system that we're in, but basically to pick Satan as opposed to picking the devil. So you're picking two servants of the ruling class. You, of course, can't get that deep into it because, after all, you're in this lesser of two evil, you know, whole mindset and stuff. So a full breakdown and understanding never becomes implemented in your dialogue. It's just basically a scare tactics for the person you're trying to convince to vote this guy as opposed to another. And also, there's no development of the fact that this whole election process and things that we vote for and all of that within a bourgeois capitalist system are designed, in a sense, for even when certain concessions are given, they're designed to be temporary. So these things could easily be rolled back years later by the ruling class because they can play a little give or take. Meanwhile, the maintenance of their capital private power is something that is never supposed to be challenged. And those who get caught up in this whole electoral process thing don't even think about challenging that on the real, outside of, you know, little sound bites and gimmicks and what have you.
What we got to do here is any real Democrat, and that's with a small D, must inscribe upon their program and their banner the elimination of the Electoral College. That's got to go. And I'm going to show you something. I didn't really realize how unbalanced it was because I never paid much attention to these elections. But, you know, that this is what they're talking about all the time. What was that? South Dakota, 700,000 people, something of this order. They got two senators. Then you have a state like California. It's got two senators. State like Rhode Island, little tiny itsy-bitsy little state with a small population to boot. They got two senators. New York State, well over 15 million people, they got two senators. And then, you know, the electoral votes to match are not really dependent on the number of citizens in the state. It's grossly undemocratic.
But that was in part during the development of the electoral process to maintain influence amongst some of the most reactionary elements in society and states and slaveholders. That way, historically and even today, it stands for a disciplining measure for the rest of society that may be grappling with you know, certain racial issues, you know, integration, things like that. You can have the Dixiecrats develop their little Southern strategy program under Strom Thurmond and have undue influence on the process because of the undue power of the little states that, you know, cats like him reside in. So it serves as a process to always pull back, even within the whole bourgeois context, the society from advancing in even the most minuscule way, you know, within the system and stuff.
That's right. Now let's take a simple, a clear example. First of all, just to make what Tracy said to render it a little more concrete here, the Electoral College, among other concessions, were a minimal requirement for the South to enter the Union. They wouldn't even consider entering the Union on no equal basis, because they knew they were going to have less people, they had less industry, smaller cities. All right? Now, what does that mean today? Well, look, first of all, and I'm not putting people, you know, we used to talk about this, you know, in New York City, you get your cousins, some of your family come up. What we used to call them when they came from the South, we used to say, y'all country. Because, generally speaking, they had not had access to as much culture and education. You know, of course they catch up in a few years, but it's no doubt, if everybody understands that rural areas are more socially, politically, and culturally backward than urban areas. And what this so-called electoral college does, as Tracy just said, is ensure that these more backward areas have undue influence in determining who runs this nation. Now, let me just give you a real clear example right now. This, I think his name is Gavin Newsom. Yeah, the mayor of San Francisco. He said, look, later for this, we're going to let all the gay people get married if they want to. And it started a little mini spurt nationwide. Gay people started running in trying to get married or getting married. And if they couldn't in their own states, they flew over to San Francisco and got married. And it became a big thing for gay people to get married. Now, we don't want to get into the critique of marriage per se right now. We just, you know, should gay people have the right to get married if they want to? Obviously. I mean, most people who, you know, are opponents of this system understand that people have the right to get, they ought to have the right to get married. But check out how this works. Bush and them, knowing that he had nothing to offer the working people as a class, he played that religious card real hard. First of all, he was giving money to the preachers, talking about his faith-based initiative, all this old, but he's paying them off. He's paying off the preachers. And we even had here in the city of Oakland, we mentioned here on Slavery Bowl, a little clot of black preachers, black Republicans, talking about, you know, no, we got the, God wants us to vote for the Republicans. But, you know, more specifically right now with this gay marriage stuff, they use that in order to get that Christian coalition base in motion. That became their cause célèbre. That became their issue. If you let this guy get in here, this Democrat, gay people gonna get married. Now, in fact, people should know this. To his disgrace, Kerry did not support gay marriage. But they used it anyway. What the hell? It's not the truth, so what? Who cares? Just, you know, throw anything at them. But what really occurred here, so these backward areas where people worried about somebody gay in New York getting married, and they living way out in bumfuck Iowa somewhere. Think about that a minute. Just think how ignorant that is. That leads them to choose who they're going to choose for president? Believe it or not, there were actually preachers who told these unfortunate souls that if you vote for John Kerry, you have committed a sin against God, because that's the you know, and all this old foolishness. And I tell you, the Republicans played that hard. Now you just let us get our workers' party together here so we can show you what hard really means.
Now let's go to another Hard Knock host, asking her guest about the youth vote as a victory in itself. In other words, the fact that young people just came out and voted, that's in part a victory. Check it out.
And I guess that's an important point in terms of looking at the game, that we can't look to people outside of ourselves to really validate the organizing work that we've done. And it's good to hear that, like, in terms of, like, what you guys are reporting, that really young people committed to coming out to vote and did come out to vote.
We've got, like, 90 to 100% of the people that we had signed up and engaged in our process turned out across the board.
Cool. Now, Amalia, I was wondering if you could kind of speak to that same issue in terms of communities of color and indigenous communities. I think there was the same absence of coverage of where the gains were in terms of our own organizing in our own communities. Do you have a sense of numbers or what people are claiming as of victories in the face of this really larger defeat?
Well, I think the numbers are still coming in. I think, you know, from our perspective or my perspective, is that for people of color, you know, a win or a victory isn't even about the numbers. I think for most of us, we understand just by showing up yesterday and looking around and seeing all of the faces of people of color that it was, as Adrian said, an unprecedented turnout. Whether you're talking rural America or big urban centers, everybody's talking about in the 5, 10, 15 years they've been in these communities, they've never seen people, you know, turn out like this, work cooperatively. We're hearing stories about intergenerational organizing. We're hearing stories about people working cooperatively across racial and ethnic lines. And these are the sorts of things that I think the people of color know, that when we ask each other to turn out for something important, we're there to support each other. Whether the media reflects those stories or not, I think is sort of a separate argument. But in terms of our communities, I think that we know that we were called to task and we really showed up. And so those are sorts of the victories that we're talking about. I think the numbers will come out later, and obviously most people need to crunch those numbers in order to justify their funding, in order to show that they did put together a DOTV plan that was worth the dollars and they should continue to get dollars in the future. But I think that for those of us who are really concerned about long-term movement building, it was important that we were there on November 2nd, but it's even more important that we're here on November 3rd, 4th, 5th, and every other day in the next 365 days.
All right, so once again, you have a situation where these guys are talking about how young people coming, showing up to vote is in part a victory. In other words, without an analysis of the corruptness of the system, and can you change, quote unquote, a corrupt system by playing into the mechanisms that they want you to play into? That's almost like saying that getting people to engage in the cocaine trade is in part a victory if they can, you know, make decent money for themselves, without examining that this whole drug trade is a trap. Just like in part, the whole electoral processes for presidencies and things of that particular nature. But once again, as we said before, you know, I've challenged these guys on the poll process of since they want to go, the Democrats are lesser two evils, make out a whole list of things. Get their little heroes, Chomsky, Zinzag, whoever, and, you know, say, ask 50 to 100 questions. Do you support the School of the Americas? Do you support the State of Israel? Do you support lobbyists supporting and teaching the Sudanese government, the National Islamic Front, how to manipulate the process and spin it like they're the victims somehow of black people in the South and black people who are Muslims in the West from trying to get their own self-determination. In other words, all of these particular things that are going on within the world, IMF, World Bank Program, they could be asked to carry. And if Kerry and them respond in an unacceptable percentage that they can determine, then they can't declare them a lesser of two evil candidate. But they don't do that. You know, they're not serious. Instead, they come out right before election time with all of these scare tactics and use the same sound bites they denounce the right for. You know, lesser evil, anyone but Bush, so on and so forth. These are the same type of gumpified sound bites that they denounce the Bill O'Reillys and the Rush Limbaughs from. So you don't engage in real engagement and dialogue with the masses of people. Instead, it's a horse race of quickly trying to convince people why they should vote for one demon as opposed to another without breaking down a true critical analytical understanding of the system that the masses of the people live in. Because at the end of the day, none of these people who serve these parties and none of the CEOs of the world that these parties serve, none of them are going home hungry. None of them worry about not having food on the table. None of them worry about not having a clean cup of water. So the fact that they come and represent truly a class of people, which the Democrats and Republicans do, because that's where they get most of their finance from, a class that is based in luxury, and a class that those issues aren't really an issue for them, should be an indication of where their main orientation and who our main orientation and what our main orientating issues should be about.
You know, I think it's very important, and we want to, when people said anybody but Bush, it was a dishonest slogan from the get-go, because they were not saying anybody but Bush. They were saying Kerry, and only Kerry. Because as the thing unfolded, and Nader kept trying to do his little campaign, and other people tried to do their campaign, we find out that these people were being denounced by these silly Democrats simply because they were running. Because they didn't mean anybody but Bush. They meant Kerry.
Next, now here's Zinzag talking about the third party, hopefully next time around, pulling some Democrats more to a progressive wing. Now, this is kind of shameful, because this is the same Zinzag that we did a show on where he was one of the guys who has signed a bill or a letter asking Nader not to run. So basically he was saying just go for Kerry. Now that falls down on his face, and now he's talking about third party, hopefully, pulling the Democrats once again. Then Jeremy Scahill from Democracy Now! Asked him what message is being sent overall. So let's check out this conversation. Check it.
Whether it ran a candidate 4 years from now or not, might move the Democratic Party to the point where it represents a real opposition to the Republicans.
We're speaking with Howard Zinn, legendary historian, author of People's History of the United States. Jeremy?
Howard Zinn, I wanted to ask you, what about the message that this re-election, apparent re-election of George W. Bush, the message it sends internationally and also here in the United States, with Bush winning by well over 3 million votes in the popular vote?
Well, you know, I suppose the message it sends is that the American people have been very badly misinformed in the course of this election. They have been misinformed by the media. They've been misinformed by our political leaders. And the Democratic Party, including John Kerry, did very little to change all of the misperceptions and bad information that the American public received from the major media and from our political leaders. And it's, you know, it suggests we have a huge job ahead of us to do, as was done during the Vietnam years. It took several years at that point for the American public to get over the deceptions of the administration about what we were doing in Vietnam, to realize what we were doing and to turn against the war. We don't have that much time, but I think that's our job.
See, this is a defeated person and a demoralized person.
Yes,
because
sir.
When Zinn first starts off talking about hopefully next time a third party can pull the Democrats to be in a real opposition, yet this is the same person who was involved in signing the letter to Nader not to run. So then, once again, this collapses. So then he goes back. Now, it got pointed out to him that, you know, he has a recent book that came out where he quotes Frederick Douglass about saying that there's no demand, there's no progress, and that when he gave his support to Kerry, he didn't make
no
any
demand.
So he's not even consistent in his own historical background. I mean, he's a historian. I mean, this is sad. But then
discredited
that too. Then he goes on about how the American people are misinformed by the media. Now, all of us, you know, who are involved in alternative, you know, radio systems and stuff like that, know that that's part and parcel of what is going on. But the Democrats have been neck deep, along with the Republicans, in booby trapping the media and corporatizing it. It was crime Bill Clinton who passed the 1996 Telecommunications Act. This was to help consolidate power within the whole corporate hierarchy so that the masses of people would become more and more disenfranchised and lose their autonomy. This is not something that just the Republicans are doing. This is something that both of them are doing as a social control mechanism. I mean, this, come on. Let's deal with what's real. Now, he admits that Kerry did very little to change the American populist misconception, but that's because, in part, he's down with the program. Kerry's idea for Iraq, for instance, is to send 40,000 more troops. That was his program. Kerry was the one babbling also about killing every terrorist out there. These are all code words for imperial expansionism. There's a major 14 bases being built in Iraq. There's a major embassy that's the most highly guarded embassy and that they have planned ever. It's going to, this whole region, they're spending around $100 billion just to safeguard these particular regions. Kerry never said anything about disengaging any of that stuff because he knows that's all part of the grand chessboard strategy for U.S. expansionism. And for anyone to be under some kind of illusion that Kerry was going to give some kind of alternative direction to imperial capital expansionism, which is part of the blueprint of what they feel, the rulers feel they need to do to maintain U.S. dominance, is, you know, basically in outer space. So these conversations, though, amongst these types of cats is not going on because they are demoralized and defeated, and they're it caught up in this faith-based electoral process. You know, it's all based off of faith and hope that the person that they are voting for will somehow do what they dream he will do.
You know what? This is kind of crazy because everybody knows, you know, no matter what people thought, when this silly, they had this little campaign, and then they had the various Democratic Party, you know, candidates for president going along. And when our whole little charade was over, what did they have? They had a Democratic Party program that was qualitatively similar to the program of the Republicans. So on the most important issue of the day in a country that is at war, is what is your attitude towards war, Mr. Kerry? Well, Mr. Bush says, I started it. You know I'm for it. And Kerry said, well, me too.
I'll finish it better.
Yeah. Well, what about the terrorists, Mr. Kerry? Well, Bush said, I was the first one to pip that. Well, Kerry said, I'm going to pip it too. In fact,
and proved it by voting for the Patriot Act.
That's exactly right. And the Patriot Act ain't nothing about no terrorism. Let's face that. The Patriot Act is an act against the civil rights of Americans. That's what that shit is about. We're going to stop playing games here. That's ridiculous. You ain't going to stop no terrorists by reading my mail, by looking at people, what they books they choose in the library and all of such madness. Well, what happened to the Democrats? Are they different now? Yes, there are some differences. And I'd like to just touch on them and explain where this real change happened. And it apparently nobody ever really talks about it, see? Because you see, while it is true that the Democratic Party has always been a ruling class party, the Democratic Party was somewhat open to the unions and other groups to joining the Democratic Party. They had various committees in different cities, parts of the city, different Democratic Party clubs, and people had a little teeny bit of input, and they were somewhat part of the thing. Well, what was the lesson of the 60s for the Democrats? The lesson of the 60s for the Democrats was this. By allowing people, ordinary people, to participate through the Democratic Party structures, it politicized people. And the next thing you know, some of these people learned that the Democratic Party was a farce, got experience, technique, maybe even a few skills, and left the Democratic Party to form other parties to the left of that party. So what did the Democratic Party do with this lesson that they learned? They see that, well, by being inclusive and at least even letting people participate, you wind up training people that are going to be your later opposition, because the Democratic Party always had more participation than the Republicans. At least, you know, in the 60s for sure. Well, what did they do with this lesson? They came up with this whole plan by the Democratic National Council, that is the Clintonites. I call them the Clintonites, where they use this triangulation and all. They learned that, look, the people don't matter. All that matters is getting elected. The suckers of vote, far as we don't care if 10% of the people vote. Right now, what do we got? About 25% of the American people voted in this election. No, not 25. 25% of the American people voted for Bush. All right? About 50% voted in the election. I don't know how many of the eligible voters that really is. But the point is this. The Democrats discovered, look, we don't want the people's involvement because that's troublesome. If we get the people's involvement, we got problems, potentially. If we just, you know, stay right there with the Republicans, whatever the Republicans say, we say the same thing, we got it made. Now, this strategy of copying the Republicans has wound up being somewhat of a disaster for them. Yeah, it worked for Clinton. But you know what? Did it really? Because if you look at the support that they lost in the process of doing that, and what has happened since, it looks like, unfortunately, your Republicans there, they actually got more grassroots support now in terms of these Christian coalitions, the churches, etc. Remember, the trade unions are only about, you know, there's only 10% of the working class in the unions right now. So the unions are not the main force. They can become the force with the program and the leadership adequate to the task that history is currently imposing on us. But right now, they're not playing that role. We have to, you know, concede that. We have to see reality for what it is. So you got a situation where the lesson, as the Democrats understand it, is not to engage with the public, is not to draw people into politics, but to simply play this little sick game between themselves and the Republicans, copying each other, staying just close enough to them, play that center-right game. And you know what? They're losing.
Part of the Democratic Party allowing some of the working class base to participate was, in essence, a part of an appeasement and a co-option attempt in the first place because of the independent labor struggles that had taken place, like in the 30s and 40s, that had ripped fear into the ruling class and the Democrat and Republican Party. You had all types of labor unions that had their own independent papers that were being read just in the same way that the New York Times was being read. They had the class angle to all kinds of world events and national events in the same way the Wall Street Journal puts out its publication for its particular constituents. So within that, in the same way that the New Deal was a concession and an attempt at co-option, so were certain aspects of what happened with the Democratic Party in trying to put on a good appeasing face for the working class. What's happening now since then with the crushing of so much of the labor movement, the radical movement in America and throughout the world, and world struggles collapsing against, you know, in the face of imperialism. And instead, you see the growth of various reactionary forms, sometimes, quite often, former collaborators with the ruling class in America having fallen out. That's what's been taking place lately. Noriega fallout, Osama fallout, Mobutu was kind of a gradual, you know, falling out slash no need for him anymore. Saddam, yeah, Suharto, you know, on down the line, and much of their work had already been done in crushing the working classes in their particular society. So what has grown up in the wake are reactionary forces. And the U.S., with its own society being in a kind of a reactionary hocus-pocus mode, you know, there's a new documentary out, you know, G.W. Bush, Faith in the White House, you know. Basically, it's just it would do Osama proud if Boy George was chanting Allah, because, you know, it's the same type of, you know, whole mindset and stuff. And much of the population is on that mode now. Instead of looking at things in a class way, they're looking at things in this quote-unquote moral values way, personal moral values quote-unquote way. In other words, how a person conducts him or herself with their loved ones, with pre-marriage, post-marriage, abortion, all of that. Moral values within the context and mindset of the ruling class. In other words, the ruling class is basically saying you should be concerned about moral values concerning your own personal types of affairs, not corporate moral values, you know, because there isn't any except greed. And expansionism and exploitation. So DynCorp having slaves, you know, in Bosnia, you know, having all these little girls, their CEOs, holding them as sex slaves and stuff, that shouldn't be condoned. The fact that you have a higher chance of being killed in the workplace because of corporate crime and neglect than you do from being killed from street crime, actually about twice as high. The moral value analysis about corporate criminality there is something you shouldn't concern yourself with. It's all of this, you know, Dr. Phil, Jerry Springer, you know, all of these little, you know, silly TV shows, you know, with the judges on them and all of that. That type of personal, quote-unquote, moral value type of thing, you know, Larry Eldridge, all junk. Just like the ruling class wants, and just like their servants, the Democrats and the Republicans want. Now, next, here's an NAACP spokesman, Julian Bond, commenting on hearing Kerry is about to throw in the towel, basically. So let's check out what Bond has to say.
Well, I hate to hear it. I can't say it's totally unexpected. This election, I think, sends great shocks to everyone in the progressive community who worked awfully hard, did everything they could, and found that that wasn't sufficient. But I don't think people ought to take it as a signal that they ought to surrender and give up. It's been interesting to listen on the line to the two previous speakers to talk about the challenges that lie ahead of us. And to a certain extent, had Kerry won, some of those challenges would still be there. So we've got to, you know, find out what we didn't do enough of on November the 2nd, what our opposition did to us to make this result occur, but move ahead. This is a time to move on, to keep on with the struggle. We've lost other elections in the past. We're going to lose other elections in the future. There are some bright spots in this one. Record African-American turnout, record turnout by young people all across the country, victories in Illinois and elsewhere. So despite the bad news, we've got to push on.
Okay, now you can hear basically what he's saying, you know, subtly, is like when he makes comments like what our opponents did to us. What he's basically saying is your Democrats, not your opponent. They're not your opponent opposition. So thereby, if you believe that jargon, they're not your class opposition.
Yeah.
See, this is how this type of soundbite and cliches sucks people in from not being class consciousness and understanding what the hell is really going on. You got the Julian Bonds types talking this, you know, droned out rhetoric and painting the Democrats as your class ally. Now, as I've said before, you know, Kerry is down with the IMF World Bank program. He's down with structural adjustments. He voted for NAFTA, GATT. He was down and voted for the WTO. These things that I just mentioned, along with the Patriot Act and the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act by Crime Bill Clinton, which was a precursor to the Patriot Act, but these other mechanisms, along with him being for the School of the Americas, is how the world is being turned into a giant Indian reservation. The World Bank structural adjustment programs are imperial programs for control, genocide, and destruction, and the loss of one's autonomy throughout the world. And it's going to help foster people's rage and reactions of despair throughout the planet, because it's a program to crush into the earth the masses of the people. It's imperialism by design. Now, Kerry was right along with Crime Bill Clinton during the whole process of sanctions, which liquidated over 1 million people. Kerry didn't blink an eye during that whole process. It was, and let's not forget, it's Senator Kerry. It's Senator Edwards. Now, watch 9-1-1 again, when Fahrenheit. When those blacks, Congress people, were trying to get one senator to sign, Kerry and Edwards were senators then. They could have signed to have an investigation done on how black people and others were disenfranchised by Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush and the Republicans under the phony software, or the wretched software program that they use to create this fake felony list. But Kerry and Edwards sided with trying to maintain the false integrity of empire. as opposed to the basic voting rights of black people. So if they weren't even down for black people then, it shouldn't be too surprised that they're not really down with the masses of people truly having their voice out and being recognized in any way, not even through this fake electoral process. So what Bond talking about, you know, we still would have had to fight Kerry on some of these issues, even if he had been elected, when Kerry's just as deep into the imperial expansionist mode as Boy George is, he's just a little bit more articulate, is basically a shoeshine job. So this whole thing with Bonds talking about what we should do and all of that, none of it is going to have any real class combative aspects to it for the interests of the working class outside of the box that the rulers and their servants, these Igors, Democrats and Republicans, want us in.
Because, in fact, as we just said, why do the Democrats advocate a qualitatively similar program? He even had to give a little credence to that, because everybody knows that Kerry was for the war and for this madcap anti-terrorism crusade, or whatever you want to call it, they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
How is it? Because both of these political machines, they're not really parties. They don't come together and decide policy. The bourgeois cliques basically create their own consensus amongst themselves, and they use these so-called, particularly the Democratic Party, as a political machinery. And it exists to protect and extend the power of the bourgeoisie, the American ruling class. When you understand that, you can't be fooled with all this hocus pocus.
And as I said before, you know, to get into some of the little quote-unquote various differences, quote-unquote, between a Democrat and Republican, it's basically to shoeshine yourself in a sense, because that's like talking about the differences between the LAPD as opposed to the New Mexico Police Department. Basically, they are in different regions and have different constituents. But you know, the LAPD, of course, being in, you know, the kind of large city and, you know, a large urban area, so on and so forth, of course, they're going to be more militarized and so on and so forth. The New Mexico police, you know, are in a more rural area, so they don't have the same type of SWAT type of mechanism running through. But that's just because they don't have to. If New Mexico were to change, they would just adjust to it, because at the end of the day, they're still the police, and their job is to maintain order for the ruling class.
That's it.
But next, let's go on to to help show how corrupt the Electoral College system is in a historical way. Here's Jasmine Rankin. He's an American University law professor, and he deals with some of the reality about how this electoral system was set up and basically whose interest it really serves. So let's hear a little bit of sanity for a while. Check this out.
Well, I think Juan put his finger on what's going on here, which is that our political institutions were structured by a determination to protect slavery in the South. And so all of our political institutions have a pro-Southern tilt to them. The Electoral College can only be understood as being intertwined with the history of slavery and white supremacy in the country. The Southern states were looking for a way to combine the disproportionate power they got through the U.S. Senate with the House of Representatives, where they got disproportionate power through the Three-Fifths Clause, counting the slaves, 60% of the slaves, to inflate the power of the slave masters in their congressional delegations. And so the Electoral College worked like a dream for the Southern states. Four out of our five first presidents were slave masters, And the Electoral College, all the way up through the 20th century and through today, has operated to give disproportionate power to the South, and specifically to the most conservative backward forces in the South. And we just saw that played out again yesterday. In the 20th century, there were a number of conservative Dixiecrats who left the Democratic Party in presidential elections, like George Wallace, like Harry Byrd, like Strom Thurmond, and ran for president as independents to send a message to the Democratic Party about how the civil rights movement should not be joined and should not be supported. And the Electoral College has always been a lever against civil rights progress. And today it now acts to support the most conservative forces in the country that want to increase corporate power, that don't want to deal with issues like health care for the people, that don't want to deal with environmental protection and so on. And we're getting a kind of one-party lockup of the political system through the Republican Party control of the House, the Senate, the White House, the Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, and all of these different levers of power go to reinforce one another, as we saw in 2000 when a five-justice majority, all appointed by Republicans on the Supreme Court, moved to hand Bush a victory in the Electoral College, despite the fact that he was down 500,000 votes. And they've been able to use the last 4 years, with their control over the federal budget, with their control over the federal government, with their support in the corporate media, to consolidate their political power. So if you believe the central insight of our founders about checks and balances, we're in a dangerous situation to have one-party control over all of our major political institutions.
So there it is. The whole electoral college system is based in the slave system, slavery, and white supremacy. But once again, if your whole thing is to basically play a horse race / Julian Bond merry-go-round, you're not going to go into the history of that type of aspect, because going deep into the historical aspects of these types of things to get more of a scientific analysis of what's going on brings out the class nature of the whole process, and that you don't fit as a working class person, doesn't fit within that ruling class infrastructure that was designed by them. So you then start to have a different outlook, and then you can start to see certain things that should be asked by some of these liberals and progressives that aren't asked. Like, for instance, you know, in California, basically that three strikes law, which is very, you know, reactionary, that was up, you know, to make the third strike, you know, at least be a violent, you know, felony. So the whole thing shouldn't even exist. But, you know, this was some kind of reform that people were trying to do. What ended up happening? It was over 10 points ahead. It was very ahead up to the last 2 or 3 weeks. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican, came out, spent $2 million. And his sidekick, Jerry Brown, a Democrat, came out and started making up stories and lies, pretending like, you know, all these people were going to be suddenly released, had commercials of white women victims being shown, you know, on TV. They just played a subtle race, or not so subtle, a race card game. But here's a Democrat and Republican joining hands together, and they were able to defeat this proposition and keep three strikes locked, loaded, and ready to fire at more of its potential victims, the masses of working class poor people, which is designed to do, innocent or not, quote unquote. So this whole process of what are these Democrats doing if they're supposed to be the lesser of evil?
Working with them.
Yeah. But see, that's the class aspect of how this stuff really works. And these types of things don't get addressed by those people who are trying to drone you down and get you to pull that lever for the quote-unquote lesser evil concept. Now, the cat also said, Rackin, said that he was talking about how the power to the most conservative backward sectors of the society and the country have been developed within the Electoral College because of their undue influence. Now this, as I said before, is something that the ruling class right from the beginning liked, because this will always have an internal disciplining mechanism on the rest of society. So no matter how many sectors of society are trying to take things in a more enlightened, educated, way, you'll always have, through the electoral college system, especially if you play it, a way of drawing back some of these gains and demoralizing and beat down people who choose to play in these games and hold back this society that's the most industrialized in the world and doesn't even have universal health care. That's how the electoral college system, in part, plays itself out. And what you don't see is Democrats having a problem with this.
That's right.
They'll play innocent about it, and it's like, well, this is the way it's always been. But from a class concept, if this was something that was hurting their ruling class masters, they would have a problem with it. Now, case in point, in the 70s, one of the major corporations had its workers go out on strike. And during the strike, the strikers ended up winning. And they found that the strikers won in part because not only were they getting money from their union during the strike, but they were also getting benefits while they were out, unemployed. So for the ruling class, when they did an internal investigation on how they lost the strike, they said, hey, wait a minute. The work. The welfare system is not supposed to help the workers defeat us in class combative battles and stuff. So that's when they decided to really go hard at the welfare system. Now, of course, they changed it and spiced it up, kind of like Arnold did about the three strikes, rich black women on welfare with 20 babies driving Cadillacs are, bleeding the country dry, and this is why you should be against welfare. Of course, that's the propaganda they put out there, but the real motivation had to do with the fact that this was something that was actually aiding workers defeat them in strikes in class combative battles. Now, when the ruling class went after that, by and large, the Democrats just twiddled their thumbs. And as we saw during Clinton's administration, basically put one of the major nails in the coffin, Democrat.
And they talk about the Democrats represent black people. We ain't got no damn representation. That's the reality. And if we don't see it now, it may be a while before we actually focus to see this. This healthcare crisis. Oh, man. They claim that was the one thing the Democrats said they was going to really try to do. Remember that thing with Hillary Clinton? She said, well, maybe people ought to be able to go to the doctor. And then the Republicans got up on their hind legs, and boy, she dropped that shit like a bad habit. And look what happened.
Yeah.
They came after us with a vengeance. Now, almost every worker that has health care at all, not all, but almost all, is paying a serious percentage of that premium, hundreds of dollars, to keep your health care going. And everybody wants to be able to go to the doctor if you get a little ill. These Democrats, treacherous, man. They done played it, and oh, man. The more you think about it, the more obvious it should be. Except, who's going to tie this all together for folks? And then after you tie it together and you give it to people in a coherent manner, who's going to provide the alternative program for folks? That's the job of a political party of the working class, and that's exactly what we don't have.
Now, next, Matty Bray. He's from some Islamic Muslim society or whatever. he talks about Kerry doing the beat down on his quote unquote constituents and the Democratic supporters. So let's check out what he has to say, who was also a Kerry supporter from the Islamic in America perspective. Check this out.
Well, I'm an old country boy. They say every goodbye is not gone, and certainly the candidate might be defeated, but the vision that prompted people, especially in the Muslim community, to come out in record numbers has not been defeated and cannot be defeated. We know that truth crushes the earth still rises. And that is to say that we had decided a long time ago in the Muslim community, regardless of who occupied the White House, that we were going to continue to organize our people to be politically active and to be engaging and trying to make a difference in the whole arena of civil rights, civil liberties, and certainly to try to make a difference in the policies that have been taken against Muslims here in America and abroad. Having said that, I can say that I was really quite enthused and quite encouraged by the amount of participation that I saw of Muslims for the first time, because it seemed right after 9/11 there was kind of a cynicism and a certain sense of apathy that kind of permeated our community. But I can certainly say that yesterday, as I on my radio show, we got calls from all across America from Muslim activists who were calling in and saying, you know, how active they were and how people were going out, first-time voters and things of that nature. I think for us, certainly this election 2004 will probably be viewed in the Muslim community as our Rubicon. Basically, we realize that we can never go back into the area of passivity, and that indeed we have to be active. We have to join forces with other progressive forces in this country to make sure that we can have a America that really reflects what we want for America, and that is certainly liberty and justice for all. So having said that, I'm really encouraged, because I think that the Muslim community really has seen the membrane of consciousness in terms of political activism has been back for us, and I think that we can join forces with other progressives and other forces here in America that really want to make a difference, that really want to see the war stop in Iraq and to see the situation in the Middle East resolved, really want to see that the war on terrorism is not a war against Muslims, and really want to see that civil rights and civil liberties are protected here in America. It's a long climb, but I think that we're committed to do it, and I think there are many others in America that are committed to do it. And I, too, echo the responses that came from some of the previous persons that were on, saying that I think we need to make sure that we take mass action. I think we really should not give our consent to the policies that are currently now being presented by this administration. I have to say that the greatest of injustices against the Muslims in America happens to be this particular administration, and we cannot give credence to it, nor should we just roll over. And I think that basically there are a lot of people, not only in the Muslim community, but there are a lot of people who came out for the first time, students and people who have not been in the past politically active. I think we need to go back to the drawing board, look how we can do some serious analysis of what went right and what went wrong. I think certainly for the Kerry situation, one of the things that went wrong for the Kerry administration was just, I don't think they really did the type of outreach that they really needed to do to many of the minority communities, not only the Muslim community, but African American community. And I just think that they didn't do the type of outreach. I think that basically that was one of the problems. And I think that the current conversation that came from Julian Bond about the spineless, I think that certainly not being able to talk about the war and what I think were the terms in which most of the constituents that supported John Kerry wanted to talk about it as being something that was immoral and something that we should stop certainly didn't help. And I think also the thing that really concerned me greatly was that basically the Kerry outreach and the Kerry's political rhetoric did not really address the poor. It mostly centered around a middle class, but there are millions of Americans who are poor and working poor, and it didn't seem like that he kind of, like, you know, did not respond to that constituency. So I think that if we go back and look at how we can build the broadest base for what Dr. King used to refer to as the beloved community, I think that we will still be able to maintain a victory in this country against those forces that are really what I call the forces of darkness against civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights.
Basically, there's a whole lot of hocus-pocus nothing being said, to be quite frank and straightforward. You know, to say, talk about the quote-unquote Muslim community and act as if it's this one guy, when it's all different sectors, you know, this, you know, black people who are Muslims, that probably the majority of people who are Muslims in this country. And then you got, you know, Arabs and other people who are Muslims and stuff like that, living all around, different perspectives and stuff like that. So first, there are pockets of communities, but to give this whole impression of it, it's like one big community and all riding together is somewhat suspect, to say the least. Now, of course, Kerry didn't do any outreach to the Muslim quote-unquote community. Well, it's clear five different groups of Muslim organizations and all that called Kerry, and he didn't even bother to meet with them. He just kind of, you know, I mean, just in the same way that Boy George didn't meet with the little NAACP, they're playing games of contempt on purpose. Kerry didn't want to get labeled by his constituents, I mean, by his adversaries, quote-unquote bourgeois adversaries, the Republicans, you know, Karl Rove and them, saying, you know, because they probably would have said that he had a baby by one of the black people, you know, at the church if he went, you know, to the NAACP thing. And, they would probably have accused Kerry of being some kind of Islamic fundamentalist if he had met with, sympathetic to Osama. They would have probably tried to draw some link to some guy in a group, Karl Rove and them, if Kerry had met with them. And Boy George just thumbed his nose for, you know, to make sure that his Southern Strategist program was still in focus and at heart for the people that tune into him. But, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, I've heard some of these Islamic-based shows. This guy does a show, not his particular show, where they were talking about Muslims in general. Now, I don't know if they were talking about black people who are Muslims, because it was basically Arabs who were Muslims talking about this. But they were talking like the last time Bush ran, that they voted for him, that those constituents, by and large, who were probably Arab Muslims, but they didn't say it in particular, but they were saying they were Muslims, the Muslim community type thing again, came out in force and voted for Bush the first time. And part of that is this whole values thing, you know, because a lot of people who are hocus-pocus-ized get caught up in this whole thing where, especially during these times, where the whole image of modesty, conservatism, and all of that type of stuff, you know, family values, you know, I mean, these are all things that are being manipulated by, you know, the Republicans, but they're embraced by a lot of hocus-pocus people who are both Muslims and Christians. Since Boy George got on the warpath against Muslim societies in general, since he's gotten in office, this seems to have turned some of them. But my whole point in mentioning this was that one wonders how easily one could be manipulated off this hocus-pocus type family values, moral values rhetoric by these people, regardless of what invisible man they've been their knees to, by the Republicans playing this card. So once again, it just shows the whole gumpified process that we have going on within this nation. And how easily manipulated people are by these little soundbite comments and imageries that both the Democrats and Republicans throw out there.
Well, there's another reason why Senator Kerry would not meet with the Muslims. It's the same reason, fundamentally, that the Democrats don't want to raise too much hell in the black community by registering black voters. And that is that the Democrats do not want to set the black community in motion. Because it's one thing to get people going and organizing and doing things, it's another thing to stop him.
I think that Kerry probably didn't, and probably was advised not to meet with the five little groups, because they probably told him, look, Karl Rove will probably pull something out of his hat if you go, you know. Bush has probably stirred them up enough that they're going to vote for you, which it seems like they did, regardless of, you know, whether you meet them or
but
not.
But don't give them too much encouragement, because they actually might just start getting out there and organizing and doing things.
Well, that remains to be seen. Just, I mean, because if he goes out just like Kerry does to, you know, certain groups and pats them on the head, like he's done many of these liberals and progressives, they're still locked into this whole, you know, bourgeois electoral college process.
But they
system.
Don't feel encouraged to fight for their human rights. When you start dealing with the Muslims, you're dealing with a group whose human rights are being assaulted regularly. These people have every reason to organize.
Black people have every reason and more to organize too. Masses of people in this society who are being imprisoned and so on and so forth. As a matter of fact, the mere fact of all of these roundups and stuff, that should be incentive enough. I just think basically it was just a strategic plan. They ain't going nowhere, especially if they calling me in the first place. So
that's a sign that they're probably not. But dig this, Trey. Remember, all right, you might not recall this, but on the election night, Edwards got to going, they got to talking stuff, and they said, we will not concede the election. They were thinking about old Gore last year.
Right.
We are not going to concede this election. It's too close, and we got to count every vote before we... Blah, 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 blah. They ran him out.
And then they compromised again?
They conceded. That's of right. course they did. But why? But why would he totally discredit himself as a credible human being?
Same reason as last time.
Well, largely, they did not want to leave that up in the air. Now, he talked about the national dignity. It ain't about national dignity. They didn't want the contentiousness there. Anything that gets people looking around, thinking, back to sleep.
And also, basically, challenge the false integrity of the system, just like last time, which is why Gore copped
that.
Out.
Don't want that, because actually, the more people look, the more they find. And
it's
the
basically
more they
how
see.
Court TV, one time at Court TV, basically, they would just show the court cases. They'd have the cameras in the court. You would see for yourself, and then they had the commentators on, and the commentators had to be a little bit more correct on this stuff because they knew you saw what just took place in the court that day. And what you started seeing in all these different cases, not just the big cases like the OJ and all of that, but all of the different cases they would follow, is how corrupt and inept these police and lawyers were. And it started to actually open a lot of people's eyes, where they would openly talk about it, you know, when they would call in on the show. And the commentators had to concede. Now what they basically have done is they've taken the cameras out of court, and then they got these little, right-wing diatribers blabbing to you about what happened in court that day. So, you know, Gloria right. all right.
Last thing they want you to
right.
do is think.
Right. Now, next, here's old P. Diddy. This was him before the election, yapping how on the dial of how this was going to be the turning point in American history once the youth got out and showed their power in the electoral voting process. Let's see how it worked out. Check them out.
November 2nd, we're facing a matter of life or death. Is it that serious? Hell yeah, it's that serious. When you vote a president into office, you're literally putting your life and the lives of your families in somebody else's hands. Now that's serious. On November 2nd, vote or die.
You know, 50 Cent has more power than a Kerry or Bush in these communities. You know, Ellen DeGeneres, Leonardo DiCaprio. So they wanted to use their power in a positive way. We bigger than Kerry. We bigger than Bush.
Politicians listen to numbers because those numbers equal votes. Well, according to the recording industry statistics, the hip-hop nation is over 40 million strong. So it don't matter how politicians want to break it down. You want to talk demographics like soccer moms or NASCAR dads, you're larger than them. You want to talk about focused interest groups like the NRA or AARP, we eat them. And you see how much Bush and Kerry are sweating those groups. Come on, y'all. Please, let's get hip-hop on the air.
It's going to be a historical day come November 2nd. And it's going to change the face of politics. From November 3rd on, people are going to be chasing the vote of the forgotten ones.
Nothing but illusions. Same type of hocus-pocus illusions that you heard from the Islam guy right before. This whole thing about power equals votes, you know, and thinking that just getting in the voting process is how you exercise your power. See, that's having no class consciousness whatsoever. That's not understanding the lobbying situation and the whole tools of lobbying power, corporate power, expansionism. He's yapping all this vote or die. It's basically vote and die. and how it's going to be a historical day and all of that.
And how rhetoric, this cheap.
50 Cent has more power than Bush or Kerry and all of that. Yet, he's getting on his knees and trying to get other people to get on their knees to vote for one of those guys in office. Basically, even though they're going to serve who they've already been created to serve. A whole nother class. A ruling class.
That's right.
Just a state of confusion and buffoonishism at its highest level. But next, from the hard knock heads to who are P. Diddy daddling along and being zigzagged on and bonded up. Julian bonded up in a Christian Islamic hocus pocus confusion. They should feel quite good in a sense, or maybe sad. Don't feel too sad, I should say. You're in good company, crying your carried away blues. Here's Scott McConnell. He's in executive editor for the American Conservative magazine. This Scott McConnell and the American Conservative magazine, they endorse Kerry with their headline quote, "He's the one." So here's what he had to say about Kerry's defeat, as Kerry basically is now selling on his way back to Boston in Washington down the yellow brick road. Check it out.
I think it might be different if the raw popular vote were different and Kerry's favor were very close. But I can't, to be honest, imagine how Kerry could see himself as gaining any legitimacy as a new president if he were able to, like, you know, somehow, you know, string along the Ohio process and win by a couple thousand votes, losing by 3.5 million in the popular vote. I mean, there's a lot of skepticism in the country anyway about the Electoral College. I think he, you know, makes, like, the rational decision to say that, you know, he was beaten. And I think it's quite a different situation than in 2000.
So there you have it. here's the American Conservative magazine, and it is conservative. They're endorsing Kerry because they understand, unfortunately, what all these other beat-down liberals and progressives seem to understand, that basically Bush and Kerry serve the same class. And as long as they do that, they fulfill their manifest destiny goal that him as a conservative represents. So that's the game plan there. But next, let's move on, as we're about to wrap up, to Kerry himself's message to his liberal followers. You know, Chomsky, Michael Parente, you know, the average pacifist, and on and on. Let's see what Kerry had to say to them as he gave his farewell speech. Check it out.
But in an American election, there are no losers. Because whether or not our candidates are successful, the next morning, we all wake up as Americans. And that... that is the greatest privilege and the most remarkable good fortune that can come to us on Earth. With that gift also comes obligation. We are required now to work together for the good of our country. In the days ahead, we must find common cause. We must join in common effort, without remorse or recrimination, without anger or rancor. America is in need of unity and longing for a larger measure of compassion. I hope President Bush will advance those values in the coming years. I pledge to do my part to try to bridge the partisan divide. I know this is a difficult time for my supporters, but I ask them, all of you, to join me in doing that. Now more than ever, with our soldiers in harm's way, we must stand together and succeed in Iraq and win the war on terror. I will also do everything in my power to ensure that my party, a proud Democratic Party, stands true to our best hopes and ideals. I believe that what we started in this campaign will not end here.
So basically what you have is him proselytizing, amongst other things, a continuation of imperialism. We must win the war on terror, as Kerry said. That's just the expansionism of imperialist endeavors. More people being thrust on the global Indian reservation. He talks about in election there's no losers because we all wake up as Americans. See, there's no losers for the class he represents, whether he won or Boy George won. That's what the average raggedy liberal progressive doesn't get. See, he's still going home, and his class is still going home with food in their stomach, with full health care, because the class he represents doesn't have to worry about that. It's the other class that does. But if you have people preaching to segments of our class that we should be supportive of their belly full class constituents, will forever be going around in circles, confused and demoralized, or at least they will. But Kerry keeps on with this rhetoric. We must find common cause. So he's not talking anything other than what Boy George basically in essence pushed. Values, imageries, wrapping yourself around the flag. Kerry used it himself, saying we're all winners because we still wake up as Americans. So, because there is no common cause when your job is being outsourced by the class that's outsourcing it. But see, Kerry doesn't deal with that aspect because his job is that of a jackal, that of a magician, to throw smoke in your eyes and to keep you confused on what your class goals and orientation and how you, as a class-conscious person, should be fighting for your own autonomy should be broken down.
Yeah, about who you are. So after a hellish struggle, I'm still a wage slave. That's what I'm looking at. And that's why we got Slave Revolt Radio. This boy must be out of his damn mind. I guess that's supposed to console you. You're supposed to think, oh, I'm still an American.
Well, basically, it sounded like he listened to Hard Knock Radio, you know, The Thrill Is Gone, and heard Zen, you know, and all of those other guys, and then just said, look.
Don't worry.
You're still an American.
You're still an American.
Your kids don't have any food in their stomach, but you're still an American.
You'll
die an American.
That and $1.15 to get you on the barn.
Right. But here, to wrap this up, is a Boy George. And as I said before, to you liberals and, you know, hard knockers and all of that, it's Daddy George to you guys. Here's George talking in code about more good old-fashioned internal and external class warfare with help, as you heard, from his comrade, Kerry. Check it out.
We'll continue our economic progress. We'll reform our outdated tax code. We'll strengthen the Social Security for the next generation. We'll make public schools all they can be. And we will uphold our deepest values of family and faith. We'll help the emerging democracies of Iraq and Afghanistan. So they can grow in strength and defend their freedom. And then our servicemen and women will come home with the honor they have earned. With good allies at our side, we will fight this war on terror with every resource of our national power, so our children can live in freedom and in peace. Reaching these goals will require the broad support of Americans. So today I want to speak to every person who voted for my opponent.
Who's your daddy? That's basically what he has to say.
To make this nation stronger and better, I will need your support, and I will work to earn it. I will do all I can do to deserve your trust. A new term is a new opportunity to reach out to the whole nation. We have one country, one constitution, and one future that binds us. And when we come together and work together, there is no limit to the greatness of America.
Well, there it is right there. You know, Boy George is going to continue on his imperialist mission, just like Kerry said he would have when he's talking about we must win this war on terrorism. Boy George has said that we're going to help keep emerging a democracy in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, with 14 bases, an embassy, and the theft of all the oil, one can get their little bloody hooves sucked into. Public schools under attack, and all of that. And that's all in alignment with the Democrats. Because at the end of the day, whether one wants to sing the blues or not, they're singing their marching song right up these little liberals behind. Hold up a second. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up, Slave, tonight. It's clear that it's not going to take the false power of the vote to cleanse us of this madness, but the power of the soul, the revolutionary soul, to deal with the enemies at hand. So until the next time, slave revolt. Out.